Okay. By way of just by way of brief review, this will be out of lesson six, or review questions, lesson six, number three. Goes back to the first chapter. Against what does the wrath of God reveal? Okay, these are the easy things. Ungodliness and unrighteousness. Okay. It says invisible facts revealed about God by the things He created. What were they?
His divine nature.
Sorry?
Talking about His divine nature.
His divine nature. Okay. His power. This is His eternal power. As we got into chapter 1, as we covered chapter 1, and I have a similar question on parts of chapter 2, when he summed up his discussion in chapter 1, going all the way to the end there, what was the conclusion that he presented?
That both the Jew and the Gentile were without excuse, and that they were both guilty of disobedience.
Well, not exactly.
Well, therefore, you are without excuse, chapter 2.
Yeah, that's chapter 2.
Okay.
You're ahead of it.
Okay.
Chapter 1, verse 32.
They're worthy of death.
They're worthy of death, those who practice and condone the things he's been talking about. Okay. So he's dealing with the primarily the Gentiles, although if we talked about it, would have application to anybody who fit what Paul had to say. Going into lesson 7, just because of the questions today, we've covered this. What conclusion, when we talk about the second chapter, what conclusion did Paul drive to in the second chapter, the first half of the second chapter? What was his point? What was his point or point?
You're going to face the same judgment as those who are unrighteous if you practice these things, even though they call yourself a Jew.
Yeah, even though you condemn the things, you're practicing yourselves, and you're subject to the judgment of God as well. And so God was going to judge all life. And we've talked about this time and again. We keep reemphasizing verse 2, chapter 2, verse 11. There is no partiality with God. Okay, and then we went on in the rest of chapter 2 and talked about who? Jews. What do they place their faith in? According to chapter 2.
Law.
Okay, the law. What else?
Circumcision.
Okay. You even back up before the law and circumcision.
In themselves.
And who were they? Right? Man. They were the Jews. They were the nation of God, the chosen of God. So they rested on these things. They rested on what amounted to their self-righteousness as well. Okay. Page 19 in your lessons. We're going to start in chapter 3, verse 1. It says, let me bring this down in 2. Finishing up in 2. Or the lead in from 2, I guess. We had talked about them being the fact they were relying on the law, the fact they were resting their case on the fact they were Jews, they depended on a covenant relationship with God, through which had the sign of the circumcision. Of course, that became associated with, circumcision itself became associated with, we are the people of God. And Paul makes the point that one is not a Jew who is circumcised outwardly, but is circumcised inwardly. As the praise of God. So, I mean, here's what the Jews have been depending upon. God, Paul takes that right out from underneath of them. So, a logical next step would be the question, then what advantage has the Jew, or what is the benefit of circumcision? And Paul answers it with great in every respect. First of all, that they were entrusted with the oracles of God. Paul starts to use from chapter 3:1 and on a technique we've seen you see him use frequently in his dialogue. The idea of basically a conversation between a couple of characters. In this case, Paul's asking the questions and answering them. These are questions the Jews would raise. And it's almost out of, think about what you've done so far. It's kind of visualize, almost out of frustration. Well, then what's the advantage of being a Jew? You just told a circumcision wasn't worth anything, and these other things aren't worth anything. What's the point? And he answers it in no uncertain terms. What were the, this is an advantage. He says they were given the oracles of God. But that it didn't stop there. That carries with it something. What were the advantages that came to the Jews? We're going to talk about some other aspects of their history or their dependence on certain things, but what were the advantages that came with this?
They were his chosen people and his holy nation. He was their God. He gave them the land. He gave them wisdom and understanding. And he made them strong and prosperous, he took it away.
Under what circumstances did he make them strong and prosperous?
If they were
obedient. They were obedient. Sorry?
If they kept it.
Yeah, they kept the word. And, of course, I gave you some references, Deuteronomy, I think we're familiar with a number of these, Deuteronomy 4, where Moses is giving a recap. And this word, it's like Linda said, that all the things provided, or God provided for all those things, provided they'd keep his word. In particular, the thing that always impressed me about that section is they would be seen by the nations around them as somebody different. Of course, the other thing the word provided is it set the basis for the very thing they would trip over. Prophesied the coming of the Messiah, which they would ultimately trip over, that is Jesus. So they were blessed, a blessed people. They did have an advantage. The Gentiles did not have the Word of God revealed to them in the way that the Jews did. And so they really didn't have a reason to complain, and yet they did. The second objection that Paul goes on here, or they raise in Paul's voice, what then, if some did not believe, their unbelief will not nullify the faithfulness of God, will it? May it never be, but rather, let God be found true, though every man be found a liar, as it is written, that you may be justified in your words and prevail when you are judged. What was the problem with the Jews? Boy, that's an open, big question. What was the problem with their obedience?
They weren't.
They were unrighteous, weren't they? They had not been obedient. And they really, there's a question being asked here. I'm not sure that the question being asked is if it's in the present as much as it is in the past. And that is, look, consider the fact that what Paul said so far, and he's basically been working on pulling the rug, if I can use that vernacular, pulling the rug out from underneath the dependency of the Jewish mindset and pointing out a number of things that set them that should have caused them to think about, are we really not blessed, but as unique? Are we really God's only people? Like we've been thinking, and they've been charged now with not obeying the law, but depending on the law, but they haven't kept it. He's made it clear in no uncertain terms that for the law to be of any value, you got to keep it. So it would not be illogical for them to ask this question: if you had this word and yet you were unfaithful in it, does that mean that all the promises God has made to us are not going to be met? Is God going to be unrighteous, in other words, and not do what he said he was going to do? And of course, Paul answers that question. Let God be found true, though every man be found a liar. God's going to be righteous. God is righteous. And God does not lie. He's not going to be unfaithful. to his promises. The problem was, of course, their view of what those promises were was not, in fact, interpreted right on their part. And of course, their blessings, any of the blessings they should have expected, were conditional. And were given that way over and over again. And time again through the history of the Jewish nation, they had had a chance to repent and had failed to do so, which ultimately led them into captivity and things we know from their history. So the Jew himself really depended upon, in a way, was depending upon God being righteous, even though he, the Jew, was unrighteous. But, when the way Paul presents this, you can just kind of get in the mind of a Jew who's receiving it, that, things are that bad, is God basically going to depart from us? Is he going to be unrighteous in his reaction and take away the blessing? Okay, then it goes on in his third objection in verse 5, but if our unrighteousness demonstrates the righteousness of God, what shall we say? The God who inflicts wrath is not unrighteous, is he? I'm speaking in human terms. May it never be, for otherwise how will God judge the world? But if through my lie the truth of God abounded to his glory, why am I also still being judged as a sinner? And why not say, as we are slanderously reported, and some claim that we say, let us do evil that good may come. Their justification is just. What is, in your own words, so what's the logic behind this question that now is being asked?
Our sin necessitates the grace of God, so sin more grace.
Okay.
Some say Adam and Eve sinned so they might have grace, so that was good. Have you heard that?
No, but I can understand. I mean, it follows on to that teaching.
We wouldn't have the grace and all the other things that God, gave us
the sin. Right. So we ought to thank him, right?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. But it should also, in our unrighteousness, that we think that maybe that God is faithful to us as a people or something, so that he won't inflict his wrath on us. That's our human reasoning. It's, people think that God's not going to punish everybody. There's no condemnation. There's no judgment.
Well, in this case, it is a little bit of all that. But in this case, I think what they're saying is, look, if we're being unrighteous, and you've made that point over and over again to us. But if our unrighteousness gives God an opportunity to demonstrate his righteousness, then why in the world are we being punished for that? That would be their logic. Okay? And Paul backs that up, I think. I think that's what this next piece is. He backs it up in verse 7. First of all, he says in verse 6, no, that wouldn't be the case. But if that's the case, God couldn't judge the world. And they knew God was a righteous judge and the unrighteous would be judged. They knew that about the Gentiles. They had a hard time accepting it in their own case. So God was going to be able to judge the world. Paul then gives him his own example. He says, if their logic's right, that is, by their unrighteousness, they're showing the righteousness of God, letting God demonstrate his righteousness. Therefore, how can God punish us? Would be some way that would go with that. Paul uses his own case. If through my lie the truth of God abounded to his glory. Of course, he'd been, the other side of this, he's teaching truth, justification by faith. Okay? He says, if through my lie, quote unquote, the truth is being of God is bounded to his glory, why I'm also still being judged a sinner. That is to say, why are you still judging me a sinner? If that's be the case.
Why the Jews?
Why would his audience be judging him as a sinner? And And why not say, let us do evil to good may come? That's the logical conclusion of what the question they were asking is. They're really saying, let's do evil to good may come. They're really saying, we do evil. You know, that's their argument. I mean, not their argument, that's just the case. We are unrighteous. Okay? And it allows God to show His righteousness. Well, Paul's argument to that, or his comeback to that by his own example is, you know, y'all say that through my lie, or rather, if I'm in fact lying, and yet God is glorified, then, you know, the logical conclusion of that is we ought to all do evil that's so good can come. And that's just not, you know, he cuts that off the knees. That kind of condemnation is just. So this is a, you know, it's a, if you think about it, try to put yourself in the Jew's head, and you're going to get more and more of this as we go through. You know, this is sort of crosswise to where they think about themselves. You know, he's destroyed in a chapter of this writing, he's destroyed a position very strong in the mind of the Jews. Now, I don't know whether they, how well they would accept it, that Jewish mindset. Comes through. So he asks this question in 9. What then, are we better than they? Not at all. By the way, you might read that, just at least tells me. He says, but if through my lie the truth of God abounded to his glory, why am I also still being judged as a sinner? And why not say, let us do evil that good may come, their justification is just. Stay away from it for the, as we are slanderously reported by some. He asks in 9, what then? And I ask you the question, who's the we and they? In verse 9.
I put we the Jews and they the Gentiles.
Okay, there's one answer. Anybody get a different answer?
I've got the, my other thing was the apostles that preached the gospel versus the slanderers.
Okay, that's one another answer.
I thought it was the Christians versus the world.
There's another idea. I thought this was a simple question.
Believers versus non-believers.
Believers versus non-believers. All right, now let's stop and think for a minute. In fact, don't stop at verse 9. See, I ask these questions. These seem like simple questions, right? This book is not difficult. I'm not trying to make it difficult. Here's the reason I said take out the parenthetical for a minute, because it's really one of the we's that was thrown on the table. I think you can take it out. Who's he been talking to?
Jews.
Go to verse 10 and on, right down through. We're going to get ahead of ourselves, but remember context. He goes through 10, down through 18, talking, quoting out of the Old Testament. He's going to talk about what the Old Testament has to say about men and their sin. And he says, now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks of those who are under the law. Who's he talking about now? I mean, who's under the law?
Jews.
So he's talking about Jews up here, he's talking about Jews down there. The Jews have just asked of him 3:1, well, what advantage has the Jew? He's talking about Gentiles? No, he's talking about Jews in terms of what advantage do we have? We thought we had an advantage with people of God. He wrote right on down, what then? They finally come to the conclusion, they come down to this point, sort of out of frustration, in a way. Well, out of frustration, maybe out of hope. What then, are we better than they? Because what has he said all along here? God is going to be righteous. So in spite of what you do, God's going to be righteous. He's going to judge you right. So Paul's destroyed them, and yet he comes down in verse 5, 6, 7, 8, and says, God will remain righteous. Well, what then? Are we better than they? Are we Jews better than they? Gentiles is what I think he's talking about. Because God still has a relationship with us of some sort. It's not much of a relationship. Okay? Not okay, but it's the we and they could be. I mean, I had three or four things came on the table. I got these glaring. I get these glassy looking eyes all around.
Well, in verse 29 and verse 30 down, is God the God of Jews only? Is he the God of Gentiles also? Yes, of Gentiles also. Since indeed God, who will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised through faith, is one. He just keeps on talking down through there. All
right.
Under sin, all fall short of the glory of God.
The Jews, if you're a Jew, a logical question would be, and one of the questions would be, might be, are we worse than they? Another question, are we better than they? Remember, the Gentile, in the Jews' mind, the Gentiles were unrighteous people, totally unrighteous people, sinners. And God, they were not God's people. The Jewish mindset was, we as Jews are special people. And
definitely superior to the Gentiles.
And in their view, they were. Okay, and so somehow they come away with a conclusion, or raise this question again, are we better than they? And Paul answers it, not at all, because we've already charged. Now, who's the two people he's charged? Both, Jew and Gentile. That's who he's charged. And there's your answer to your question, William Hay. He's charged both of them. And so they're all under sin, all men are under sin, and he goes into a, as is written, to make his point. Okay.
So Wally, before you go on, I got one quick question.
Yeah.
Verse 7,
mm-hmm.
I know I'm backing up, but I want to make sure I understand. But
if
through my lie, what is my lie you're saying is referring back to verse 5, this statement of...
No, through his lie, it is, that is Paul giving an example, and that, an illustration. Paul's giving an illustration is what that is. And that lie... is what did the Jews, knowing from harmony, what did the Jews charge Paul with? He used his book for that matter. What was Paul being charged with?
He was
speaking. If you go back to Acts, just go back to Acts 15 for a minute. No, salvation is not by
circumcision.
No, Paul, you're lying. That's wrong.
Okay, so you think that
as an example,
my lie referred is Paul.
Yeah, they knew what he was talking about. Oh, yeah, it's Paul's lie.
Not,
I'm sorry.
Not representative of the Jews in general.
Oh, no. It's Paul's lie.
That's
sorry.
Their viewpoint
okay.
on the gospel.
Yeah. Sorry?
I was taking it as their viewpoint on the gospel.
Right.
Yeah, it's his lie. It's his, the lie he's promoting. Okay. And yet the truth through his lie... the truth of God abounded. That you can take that one of two ways. The truth of God abounded in the sense of the figure of speech, the impact abounded. It brought about a change. It brought about people being converted.
Also,
so why am I being, if it has that kind of result, and there are people who are turning to God from the Gentile world even, then why am I being called a sinner, judged as a sinner?
Well, where in this context was he accused of lying? I'm trying to...
Verse 7. Oh, it isn't in the context. He's doing an illustration, giving his own, using himself as an example. You got to go to harmony to come up with a lie, I think. I don't think he's lying. You can look at Romans in terms of the what he's preaching in Romans, that is justification, the gospel of justification by faith.
Right.
But if you're, think about where Paul had trouble with the Jews. Where Paul has trouble with the Jews is in the whole issue of what's required for salvation.
Right.
And all along his history was to be held, or was to be accused of that kind of a, that lie, if you please, that, saying that that's all that's required. You're not required to be circumcised. You're not required to do any job to rest on the law, rather live under the law. Now, that's all in here. And you can say, well, contextually, that's the lie that's all through here. But I just step out from it and say, look, no, we all know what Paul's experiences were. And so the lies that Paul taught, the lies, quote-unquote, that would have been attributed to Paul by the Jews would be what he preached as the gospel.
But there's no passage anywhere where that's tied about this, where they actually accuse him or tell him that's
a
lie.
Lie?
That's what I'm saying.
Not that I know of, not where that term is used, no.
That'd be tough for a lot of people to understand.
The tag lie is the Jews' summary of what Paul preaches.
Correct.
Okay.
Right.
Now, which brings me back to verse 16 and 17 of chapter 1. This is what he's preaching.
Sorry, what? Sorry? Linda, what did you say?
Oh, which brings me back, to that they were looking for this lie that he's written. He started out, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also the Greek. Not only did the Jews think that circumcision was for salvation, a necessary salvation, they didn't want to talk, they didn't want the Gentiles to be saved either. I mean, that's why they stoned
Careful.
You know, all that. But they
did
not
in their history.
To, yeah.
Yes.
All through Acts and all through the they didn't want the Gentiles to be taught. Okay. They didn't want them to be saved.
Right.
So, but you know, it's the gospel. The lie of the gospel by grace to me is also, you know, sort of a part of it. This is because then he has to turn around because he's telling these Jews
it's not
the works of the law.
Okay. This is where Ryan and I had this conversation about this letter too.
Mm-hmm.
Here's where that gets important, I think. Who is this letter to?
Saints. Be careful how you answer this question.
So it's the saints. Who have we been talking about?
Jews
and Gentiles. Is he talking in the abstract?
No.
He's talking to Gentiles who are. He's talking to Christians who are Jews and Gentiles, isn't he? Did the Jews want the Gentiles to be saved?
The good ones?
No.
The good ones?
Paul is a Jew.
Yeah.
You didn't want the Gentiles to be saved?
By Jews in general, no.
The true Jew.
The Jew was Christian. Did he want him to be saved? They wanted him to be circumcised, but he still wanted to be saved, didn't he? Yes. Okay. So, I don't think we're... I don't want to get off on a tangent on this, but I think you're going to find as we go through this book, Paul isn't talking to, I don't think, his audience isn't the Jew that's out on the street. He didn't write this letter to the people of Rome. Let's say it that way. He wrote to the saints of Rome. Okay. And so, you know, just like in Jerusalem, which is a little clearer to us, there were Christians, Jewish Christians in Jerusalem, who still were just like what we've been reading here. Jews, who still rested on the law, who still
circumcised.
Okay, enough of that.
Okay, I have a question. I totally, completely understand, when I read this, up to verse 8, I was thinking something completely different, but I can see that if our unrighteousness gives God the chance to demonstrate his unrighteousness, why are we being punished? I can understand them saying that. But I thought he was talking about, how unbelief doesn't nullify God's, promise. Just because God's not going to reward the people that didn't believe doesn't nullify his promise. And that if God rewards unrighteousness, then that makes God a liar. I thought that's what it was saying. How do we know that that's not what it's saying? I think I'm just missing something.
It is what it's saying, but the application is to the Jews. In other words, the Jewish people, the Jewish mindset, he's accused them right now of being unrighteous.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so the fact that they are will not destroy the righteousness of God. Mm-hmm. He will fulfill his promises. He is not a liar in spite of their unrighteousness.
Mm-hmm.
It's just... what you're saying is true, and maybe what I said wasn't clear. It's just in this context, it's that his audience is the one that is in the dialogue with him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's their specifically their unrighteousness that's in view.
Mm-hmm. See, but I guess the way I was reading it, it changes the meaning of everything. Verse 5, but if our unrighteousness demonstrates the righteousness of God, by that I thought it meant if we, you know, if we sin and we still are rewarded and we get to go to heaven, you know, what does that say of God? That says that, you know, God's a liar. So.
You're just making, well, I think you're making an application out of the context, which is okay for us, for any individual, right? And that's your point, that if any man's sins is unrighteous, that doesn't mean God is going to
reward them, because that would make him a liar.
He's not going to reward them. True. He's not going to reward us either.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But the point here, I think the point here in this context, strictly, is where the Jews were coming from and their view of what they've just been told.
Okay.
So that's the only place I would...
So it's still saying that, it's just more specific.
I think it's more specific in this case.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Stick with the, I mean, if you stick with the text and the context. But you can make application, and I think about this when I teach this subject, you can make application, things in here you make application of. But we got to be careful in these first 11 chapters. Some of the things are unique to the people he's writing to. And you just need to be careful about that, that's all. We get lots of application. I mean, there is application. Obviously, the whole first chapter is application. It has application. Chapter 1, 16, 17 has big application, right? So, and we get into chapter 12, that's all practical application as far as us. But there's something we learn here. But just don't lose sight of who's being written to and who's in view. And so, because this stuff builds on itself as well. And you may get tired of hearing me say some of the same stuff for that reason. So it's a good point. It's just, when you try to look at it from their standpoint, where would they be coming from was all I was trying to get on. Okay. By the way, incidental proof in verse 8, ends justify the means? No. Ends do not justify the means. Let us do evil, or in this case, means justify the end. Okay, verse 9. Verse 10, verse 9, we've already stated.
Verse 10?
Yeah. Ooh. Sorry.
Verse 7 one more time.
Yes, sir.
Clear my mind. The way I read that was, if the truth of God is increased in my life to His glory, which Paul's lie to me is the fact that Christ is the Son of God.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. That the unbeliever, no matter what he says, if he says what's right, he's going to suffer just like the Jew would suffer. In other words, if you say it with an unbelieving heart, if you live the life which you truly believe, in other words, if you come to every church service and you really don't believe, you're coming for man as opposed to for God, you know, you're going to be judged unrighteous.
Well, I don't disagree, but I don't. That's not what. I don't know if that's what this is saying. I don't think that's what this is saying. And in particular, who's saying it? Think about who's saying this. Who's making this statement?
Paul.
Paul.
Right.
He's talking about himself. What's the lie?
Well, I'm saying in the Jews' eyes, what he's saying is a lie.
Yeah, and what is it? Not to say Jesus is Christ, but rather that justification by faith, the whole gospel. Because presumably, if they're Christians, they would accept that, even if they're Jewish Christians.
See, I carried the pronoun through of we. I thought Paul was talking to the Jew there and saying, my lie is the fact that I think I've got this special relationship with God, which is a lie, in a way. That's why the pronoun there is important. What is my really Paul, or is it...
Verse 8. The reason I reached verse 8. He's talking about himself. Okay, so you can take either way. Let's not bury ourselves in this. Okay.
Well, you mean the parenthetical in verse 8.
Exactly. Okay. All right. I mean, the parenthetical does describe who this is being said about. Okay. So, back to 2:11 says there is no partiality to God. 3:9 says we've already charged that both Jews and Greeks are under sin. There is no partiality. You sin, you sin. You're under the judgment for your sin. Okay. And then he goes on in verse 10, and there are a series here mainly of Psalms. I think there's some verses out of Isaiah that are quoted here as well in the New Testament, from the Old Testament. He goes ahead and describes and what reinforces, if you please, how or the fact that even in their own, in the Old Testament, the point was made that men are sinners. And you know, there's several ways you can look at this. We're not going to go in and talk about every one of these. But in terms of just trying to describe generally, if you look at 10 through 10 through 12, you know, just a general description of men's sin. If you look in 13 and 14, you see kind of sins of speech. Then 15 through 18, sins of their conduct, sins of conduct. And, you know, it paints a picture of some pretty vile behavior, doesn't it? And then he caps it off, though, with verse 19, which is really what I want to hit to. It says, now we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be closed and all the world may be accountable to God. Because by the works of the law, no flesh will be justified in sight, but through the law comes the knowledge of sin. Remember, we've been looking at, we've been talking to the Jewish view, rested on the law, circumcision, etc. And Paul says, okay, he's telling them they didn't yet obey it, they had to be justified. He says, okay, let's look at what the law says. I've already charged you. Here's what the law says. It says, all men, what's it say? It says, there are none righteous, not even one. Who's the law apply to? He says to his audience. What's their conclusion? Who does the law apply to?
Everyone.
Well,
under the law.
Okay.
Under the law.
Sorry?
Under the law?
Those under the law. Alright? And the reason I say that, here's one of those here's one of those places that the views of the commentaries in terms of or the theology, if you please, of our Calvinistic friends. This is going to be where they start to get into law just being a general law, and they start to lose sight of the fact we're still talking about the law of Moses. What is above? What did he just quote out of?
Psalm of Isaiah.
Yeah, Psalm of Isaiah. The law. You know, coupled with the first five books, it is the law. And as the Jews took it, everything involved in the Old Testament was the law. The law of Moses we're talking about. Not just law. Simple law. It is true that whatever law says, it speaks to those under law. Whatever the U.S. law says, it speaks to us. We're under U.S. law. But this is not your generic law. This is still the law of Moses. Okay? And that gets important when you start looking at works. It's really not important in this statement. It gets important when you look at works.
So because I get confused there because then it says, so that every mouth may be closed and all the world may become accountable to God.
Yes.
So that's what I thought it meant. Everybody is under the law.
Not this law. He's really quoting that and making the application to the Jews because it is their law. What you say is true, it's just not this section. We are all unrighteous because we are all under a law.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, in this context, it's not the law of Moses, which is he's talking to. Yes.
Okay.
Would the phrase "all the world" just be figurative for the Jewish race?
Could be. In this case, I could find a book. Yeah, I'm going to talk about it. There's another "all" down here I want to talk about in just a second. Got to be careful when you use "all," by the way. "All" is one of those words that, like "every," doesn't always mean "all." "All" is not always "all." "Every" is not "every." So you got to be careful about that. Okay. What was the conclusion? Kind of answer our own questions, I guess. What purpose? I'm on question three. What purpose did the law serve? Why the law? The law is under view as the law of Moses. It applies to the Jews and only the Jews prior to Christ dying on the cross.
It made them aware of their sin.
Made them aware of their sin. And so, what's the result? What was the result?
They were judged by it.
They're going to be judged by it. Okay, they would be judged by it. They become accountable to God because of that law. Okay, and so you get the knowledge saying you're not going to be judged by it in the sense that we think about judgment now. But they are. They were going to be accountable to it if that's what they were going to live under. That's what they held as the standard. But really, it only gave them knowledge. The purpose of the law was knowledge of sin. Not to do what?
Forgive.
Did not justify. That's plenty of the way. Sorry, Jim.
No,
So he says in verse 20, because by the works of the law, no flesh will be justified. Okay, here we are again. This is where you start to introduce works. This is the word. When you talk about works here, what kind of works are you talking about?
Works to justify.
Works to justify. So we're dealing with a kind of work. And the reason that work to justify is it is works to justify. But in particular, in this case, is which works that justify?
The keeping of the law.
Keeping of the law works. Okay, not works of any other kind. It's works of the law. They depended on them to be justified by them.
The law would make them righteous unless they could keep it perfectly.
Right, and then they wouldn't need anything, would they? They don't need to be justified. They don't need to be made right. They are right. Just kept the law perfectly. They didn't sin. Okay. All right. So y'all confused enough now? Okay. We'll start in chapter 7, lesson 7. Which, by the way, we'll start lesson 7 Sunday. Thank you. All right. I'm gonna go back and just recap or something in a second. Question 1 and 2 are really kind of review. And as you'll see, when you get to them, you already done those. And we'll start to get into this law of works if we finish this out. Paul is going to start talking about justification by faith. He's going to, when we get through, as we've gotten through 20, Paul's going to kind of switch now, and he's going to start to expand on justification by faith. He's still going to be dealing with the Jews, not by and large. But it's going to be this justification by faith. What does it mean? And to try to show that by virtue of what it doesn't mean. Just backing up for a minute again. You've got to kind of put yourself in the shoes of the mindset of the Jew. Paul has spent this chapter 2, condemning the Jewish view that depended on the law and on their own righteousness that came to that law. And that, if you're a Jew, that had to hurt. And so the logical reaction to that is, well, then what's the point of being a Jew? I mean, we thought that was something special. What values of being a Jew? Well, there's a lot of value in being a Jew. Okay? Well, if we're that bad, does that mean that God is really not going to keep His promises? Yes.
Yeah. If our disobedience really shows that God is still more righteous, why then would he not bless us for our disobedience?
And that's the next one. That's exactly right. So, they're just, in a way, they're having trouble. I mean, you can almost, I don't know what they're doing, but you can almost visualize them having trouble with this whole thing. That they've been stripped of something that's very important to them. And, they would be, what they've been depending on, in part at least, they no longer have.
There's a lot of ego.
Paul was taking it away from them. Yeah, right.
On 3D, what answer?
Sorry.
On 3D.
3D. Number six. In lesson six.
Yes.
3D. Yes.
What answer?
They were subject to the judgment of God. They're held accountable to God.
They would not be justified.
That's a need to be made righteous is because they thought they were righteous. You know, but they come to the conclusion if they're guilty, then they have this need to be made righteous.
Verse 19, I was looking at Isaiah 59.
Yeah.
And verse 16, he said, and he saw that there was no man, and was astonished that there was no one that interceded. And then his own arm brought salvation to him. I think if those who are under the law couldn't do the law in its entirety, and therefore was not righteous before God. The world being spoken about here is the world of everybody. Because then God, brought in his own hand and sent Christ. And everybody can see that man cannot be justified by himself. The whole world is guilty before God. So somebody mentioned something about world being really just a nation of Jews. I think it's God proving the point that he had to intercede for us. The whole world is not just the Jews, who were under the law, they couldn't keep it.
Statement's true. The application, though, here to the Jewish mindset. That's all. And that happens all the time. You see that happens all the time. Keep the context, you.